All right, I'm here with Tom Wentworth. Hey, Tom, how are you doing?
Good, John. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. What part of the country are you living in these days?
I'm right outside of Boston.
Disclosing that information.
Yes, I will not be disclosing my exact location, but I will give you the approximate location a few miles outside of the Boston area.
Awesome. Well, thank you for taking the chance on the Compounded podcast and coming on board and supporting me. So I appreciate your time. There were two main topics that I wanted to talk to you about today. One was Web3, which I thought your experiences working in open source might lead you to have some interesting perspectives on Web3 and what the potential impact could be for marketers.
Yep.
And then the other one was you built out quite a publication. You've hired some pretty impressive folks on the podcasting side of things. You put the investment in, and I want to hear all about your story and how you built that case and how that's going for you.
Great topics. So
first off, you were at Acquia for a while. And so you've always been known as like a really technical marketer. And I even remember like you coded when Drift created an API, you built some applications on top of their tool. But I'm curious to get your perspective on Web3 and how you think it could potentially, how you think it relates to open source and what opportunities you think there'll be for marketers.
Yeah. So am I allowed to curse on this podcast, Sean? Am I allowed to drop F-bombs? I will not. I will try not to.
Yeah. You can.
You know, I'm with Elon Musk on Web3. It's right now marketing hyperbole. With a bunch of, VC and Andreessen Horowitz is the sort of, the main cheerleader for it. I think like always, when you dig in a little bit, there are some interesting things that are happening. I think we've got to wait and see. Like we talk a lot about the metaverse, right? And people are buying real estate in the metaverse. For one, am not buying real estate in the metaverse. I'm old enough to remember it when we called it Second Life. Remember Second Life?
Yeah.
The original metaverse. I am not spending my money on NFTs. I understand the concept. It is a great way to give creators true ownership, which didn't exist in Web2. But I believe there's better place to put my money than NFTs. Yeah. I do believe in crypto as a currency, especially Bitcoin based on scarcity. So I think there are some interesting things happening.
So I do believe in Bitcoin. Sorry.
I believe it. Yeah. No, I believe in from a currency perspective, Bitcoin is based on a scarce resource the same way the US dollar was supposed to be based on a scarce resource in gold. Bitcoin, decentralized, protects the world in the case of weird things happening around nation states. Awesome. Love Bitcoin. This is not meant to be investment advice, by the way, John. Don't go and buy a bunch of Bitcoin because of me. But you asked about open source. So Web3 can potentially solve some really interesting problems in the area of open source. Every company there are a bunch of different open source models, right? There are open source models that range from, do what you want with the code, no questions asked, to an emerging category of open source licenses that are effectively, you can do whatever you want with the code, you just can't run it on Amazon. Right. So if you're a company like MongoDB and you make money off of providing a really great platform to run MongoDB apps, you don't want Amazon just taking all of your hard work and making money off of it. So there have been new license models that have been designed really to make sure that, companies can still monetize their work. I'm most familiar with the open source project Drupal. So you mentioned I work at Acquia for a while. Acquia was founded by co-founded by the project lead and creator of the Drupal project, one of the largest open source projects on the planet. And the interesting thing is Drupal's open source license type permits anyone to do anything with the code. So it is a very permissive license type. So anyone can contribute in a bunch of ways, and lots of people do, tens of thousands of developers contribute to Drupal. But the interesting part of Drupal is around the ownership. And every open source project has a slightly different ownership model. And, there are some that are owned by open source associations, like the WordPress project is owned by the WordPress Foundation, which is a nonprofit. In the case of Drupal, it's interesting. the end of the day, the code is free, but there's a really important part of this that people don't really talk about, which is the actual trademark Drupal. And the founder of Drupal, Dries Weitzart, which I'm not saying his name perfectly right, and he'll hate me for that, is owned by Dries. So, you know, he could decide, like, I don't want people using my trademark anymore. So you can do whatever you want with the code. You just can't call it Drupal anymore. Now, okay. The chances of him doing that are literally zero. But it's interesting because he owns the name Drupal. And if you believe that there's value in the brand, which I believe there is, the Drupal project would suffer miserably if Dries decided he didn't want the project to use that name anymore. So this is an example of something that wouldn't happen in the DAO world, where you truly do have distributed ownership. So you see, open source projects are no longer tied necessarily to a person or a company. They are truly open in a way that potentially some open source projects haven't been historically. This hasn't been a huge problem to date, but I can definitely see the appeal of these, you know, new communities forming around new projects and not wanting to ever be in the position where, you know, there can be what they call Dries in the Drupal community often is a benevolent dictator. Like, he is very much a dictator. He can do what he wants to do, but he's benevolent. And, you know, I think in the Web3 world, you have the ability to sort of avoid those types of challenges.
And so is that the main business? So this is interesting. I guess I grew up in North Carolina, so Red Hat was the open source. That Red Hat's an open source project, correct?
Of course. Red Hat is a, yes. Yeah, Red Hat is a conglomerate of a bunch of different projects at this point. But yeah, they were initially built on providing support and services for the Red Hat Linux distribution.
Yeah, so that is how I had heard about open source. Is like, I thought the main business model there was professional services built on, like, to help provide support for the open source projects. But there are alternative business models, I guess, where somebody could charge a licensing fee. Like, they're not going to charge it for compound growth marketing if you use the Drupal code on that site, but they could turn it on to start charging if you were using it on Amazon site.
There's a billion different ways. So yeah, the early days of open source was monetizing support and services. Unfortunately, those aren't great businesses. They're not high margin businesses. They're good businesses, but really the big breakthrough is, as the world has moved to cloud, all of these open source projects figured out, you know, take someone, and it's not just Drupal and Acquia, take Elastic or MongoDB or really anything. And they realized that, hey, we've created this open source project, or we've been intimately involved in creating this open source project. We know best how to secure it, how to scale it, how to provide great developer tools and developer experiences. So why don't we just offer the premier place to run this open source project? Sure, you can download the code, you can secure it, you can patch it, you can scale it, you know, you can secure it, or we'll do that for you. So the way open source companies make money today is almost exclusively based on providing the premier platform to implement whatever open source project you're looking to implement. So it is sort of a best of both worlds. Like, you have the freedom to do what you want with the code, but the vendor has a chance to make money by providing the best experience. You'll occasionally see, you know, Amazon and Google and others will, you know, sometimes they'll fork their own version. Amazon has famously forked their own version of MongoDB that you can run on AWS. But MongoDB, who provides a competing product called Atlas, has thrived. They've just built a better experience for MongoDB fans. So that's sort of where the world has gone to in open source. And it's created a whole bunch of super successful companies.
Mm-hmm. And then a lot of the voting, right? You brought up a dictatorship. A lot of people talk about democracy with DAOs. But the voting happens through people building trust in someone like a Dries and spending time investing and learning how to code on top of that platform, right? So there is voting in terms of where people invest their time and energy.
Absolutely. And, you know, what all open source projects have is they have a series of contributors who are identified as they control who checks in code to the main base, right? So not everyone can check code in at a level where it fundamentally affects the core project. In the case of Drupal and other projects, there are plugin ecosystems where anyone can write a plugin, but not everyone can affect the actual core code of the project. But so there is a voting system, and that's where I think in the Web3 world, there is, you know, the potential for pure distributed ownership where there isn't the centralized control that necessarily exists today in these more centralized open source projects. And that's interesting. There's not a lot of scale here. There are no wildly successful Web3 DAO open source projects yet. There's a whole bunch that are sort of getting started. It'll be interesting to see. But it has the chance of distributing ownership in a way that hasn't been possible, you know, with the current model.
Right. And I think there's going to need to be some time and evolution there, right? Because the argument on the other side would be that these can really slow down someone's business model with everybody needing to vote or needing to get a certain amount of buy-in from people who are involved in the DAO.
I think the question is, what is the business model in the first place? For, you know, for companies, for commercial, for projects that there is a commercial entity around, take Elastic with the open source Elk product, or take, you know, Acquia with Drupal, or Automattic with WordPress. There is very much a clear, there is guidance in the project around the commercial interests. Like, we want to build things that allow us to make money. In the DAO world, you know, I'm not sure that will be the case. It very much could be. We just want to build the best project. We don't necessarily, you know, we don't need to make money. We're not expecting to make money off of it, but we just want to build a really great project. I think the commercial models around it will be interesting to see how they come together. I don't think we know the answer to that yet, the way we do in current open source projects, but I think you might see more of just more classic community, bottoms up, organic building of open source communities under that Web3 model.
And does it open up an avenue for new business models down the road? Not necessarily, like, just thinking about open source, I think the business models, the opportunities there have been somewhat limited. Is there, not necessarily with the DAOs, but do you think with like these types of communities, it opens up new types of business models that,
Of course, like, you're a golfer, I know, right? You've probably looked at the Lynx DAO community, right? Have you looked at that?
Yeah, I have. Yeah, my friend sells hoodies and is providing them with some hoodies for the Lynx DAO. So I've heard
right.
About
so, that. You know, like, you get a token that gives you access to this, you know, this vision they've put together, and potentially the ability to play all these courses they're going to buy. It sounds really cool, right? That is a business model that could not have existed before you had things like blockchain and proof of ownership and tokens. Like, that's super cool. So I think we're going to see.
I mean, like, there's Corporate Club, which you can join, and they have golf clubs all over the world. So how is Lynx DAO different than a company that owns all the golf courses and sells memberships?
I think it comes down a lot to, and it's, again, it depends on every community, right? So, but I think it comes back down to the ownership is truly distributed. It isn't a, you know, I have a membership at a golf club, and I'm not a part of the board that decides the stuff the club does.
Yeah.
But in this case, you know, if your membership card gives you a series of rights that you have to prove, you know, where your money goes, where they're going to make certain investments, right? So I think you're going to see that in some of these open source projects as they potentially look to raise money and sell tokens. You know, they get to decide as a community potentially how we reward contributors, how we fund and grow the projects. I think you'll see a lot of interesting things that are just no longer done by a small group of people, but are really representative of the community itself.
Yeah, when I look at Web3, like, one of the things that is a common reoccurring theme for me is like law. It, like, how the governance structures, it seems like with NFTs, they're like, you have the smart contracts. With DAOs, it's opening up some opportunities to do things that companies can do in one form today, but it's not like it, there's an evolution there of how these companies are set up and what they're doing and how they activate their user base and the people who are members of it. And so I tend to find that as being really interesting. Like, I don't find digital art to be too interesting. I don't find physical art to be too interesting. So I'm not
clearly, I can see the background of your room right now. It's very obvious.
Yeah. Well, I got, you know, don't knock the some of these golf posters.
Fair enough.
But yeah, I'm not a huge collector, but I think some of the opportunities it's creating around ownership and some of the opportunities it's creating around smart contracts and being able to divide up ownership is really interesting. And to me, that kind of points to law and how ownership is divided up, which I think is really interesting. So I always make the comparison of NFTs to like Amazon for e-commerce. Like, selling books was interesting, but like, if you look today and said, what's the most interesting thing in e-commerce, you probably wouldn't say, well, I can go online and I can buy any book I want to immediately. But that was their wedge in, and then it became something more interesting over time. Yeah. Thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think we could go down this rabbit hole forever. There's so many things that you could make a case. This is why this is both a very interesting technology and extreme marketing hype, as Elon Musk said. We could make an argument that our entire economy, the way we do business, the way that we think of intellectual property could all be radically transformed by Web3. I just think we're a long, long way from that actually happening.
Yeah, there's going to be an evolution over time of it. So it's an interesting space to watch.
But I have one exciting thing I'm really excited about, which is, I think, actually going to happen, which is privacy. So if you just think of, and you know, so the technical in the Web3 ecosystem, they call it self-sovereign identity, which is a fancy way of saying that we are going to own our profiles, not the shopping sites and the websites we visit and Facebook. You know, we own our profiles. These profiles are available on the blockchain. We issue access to our profile with tokens. We get to control who gets what of our data. When we change it centrally in one place. And when somebody breaks our trust, we revoke our token and they lose access to our data. Like, you just think about today, how many sites you've gone to and you've given them first name, last name, address, whatever, right?
Yeah.
And it's scary to think about how much of our data is out there and how much of our data we're trusting with people that are sketchy, like Meta. And I really think that that Web3 changing privacy, giving us back control of our own information, letting us determine what we share and letting us revoke it at a moment's notice, is going to be awesome. It's going to prevent so many problems.
Yeah. But how does that impact marketers?
Marketers better figured out a way to earn trust, right? So, trust. You know, today we collect data through all these implicit ways, right? It's, we're tracking cookies and we're aggregating cookies and we're trying to build profiles. You know, we're doing sketchy techniques. I'm sure you looked at the Cambridge Analytica stuff back in the Facebook days, right? Like, we were there, you know, they were doing super sketchy things on users. Like, all that sort of goes away. Like, there isn't a cookie world anymore. You're going to have to get explicit permission to gain access to somebody's information. And, you know, I think the trade-off has to be around value. Like, if I'm going to give you this information, what am I getting in return?
Right. It's not going to be a bad ebook written by
you. Yeah, not a bad ebook. And if you screw it, like, you don't give me any value, I can just flip a switch and turn it off again. So, you know, I think it's long-term for marketers today that have built their entire engine on, you know, and not all B2C companies do this, but a lot of B2C companies have built their engines on data collection, aggregation. It's why, you know, it's why there's the, you know, that whole CDP space exists for this, right?
Right.
I think that gets flipped upside down where now, no, I control it. You want it, you better ask nicely and tell me exactly what you're going to do with it and exactly what benefit I get in return. And if I think that's cool, then I'll give it to you. If not, you know, you're out of luck.
Yeah.
No, so I think marketing, I think we need to be prepared for a cookie-less world. Like even if, you know, we're seeing every few months, we're seeing big changes, whether it's GDPR or any sort of EU regs, like Google Analytics is now apparently, you know, not allowed in certain parts of the EU. You know, you've got California privacy laws. This is just going to become ubiquitous and we're going to be in a cookie-less world. We better figure out something else.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the keys will be around data triangulation. I also think the important, like there are a couple of companies that are doing interesting things that I think will evolve as we go on. You have Facebook and Google login on.
No, John, it's Meta, not Facebook. Is the correct name. It's Meta.
Meta login and Google login, which you can easily see that being kind of the token or whatever it is that like there is some, you log in. I've seen people use the example of like Ethereum. You log in through your Ethereum wallet ID, get in into a product, and then boom, you're able to revoke that information. I think,
John,
that's
it's stupid. Really, it is stupid to have your ID tied to your phone number or tied to your email address.
Yeah.
Like those are not good things to have your entire life tied around. I would feel much more comfortable having my identity tied around my Ethereum wallet. No, you're exactly right. Like this is what gets me excited about the future.
It was Social Security, then it was your phone number, and then it was, and none of these things were supposed to be this way.
Oh. Like
you're when I chose my email address in fifth grade, it wasn't supposed to be the ID that I used to log into Google Analytics 30 years later.
No, I'll take some big hash of you know, characters over that. But I think that, you know, you think about login, right? Those are Trojan horses for data collection.
Yeah.
The Facebook like button is a Trojan horse for data collection, right? Like all that stuff goes away. There is no more Trojan horse for data collection. It's explicit.
Yeah.
It's like yes or no, binary choice.
And then the other thing that's interesting these days is the Apple login, where you can choose, they basically create burner email addresses for you every time you create a login with someone. So there's these like web one, web two companies that are starting to kind of scrape at this. They know that it's a problem, but you can kind of see them like kind of, I don't know what the right analogy is, but it's like they see this gigantic wave coming and they're trying to paddle to get ahead of it. But like, it just seems like they have too much. Even Apple, who's like the privacy company, is still has too much at stake with like the world of data the way it is today. They would lose too much of their revenue if they gave that up.
But I think so. Apple is very clearly leading the way here, and I think I trust Apple in a way I don't trust other vendors. I'm a big Apple person, and Apple will adapt. Like Apple doesn't make money off of data. They make money off services. They make money off of hardware. Obviously, they do not make money off of data. They'll be fine. I found it hilarious that Meta, you know, Zuckerberg had to get up and talk about in an earnings call, they lost $10 billion due to iOS privacy changes. Hilarious. Super happy that happened, because that is not the world I want to live in, where Mark Zuckerberg is figuring out ways to mine my data and make money off of it. It's interesting now. Google is all of a sudden in a great spot because Google owns the, you know, Google is collecting first party data, right? You know, they're collecting your data when you're on Maps or you're in Mail or you're doing a search. They all of a sudden, I mean, they're the big winner here. Meta is the big loser, and Apple is kind of on the sidelines. Apple doesn't care because this is not how they make money.
Yeah. Yeah. Google's in a really interesting place because they capture intent. So it's like, even if you aren't collecting millions of data points on someone, when somebody goes to Google search, you know what they're looking for. When someone's on Google Maps and they type in an address, there's a ton of data in that doesn't necessarily, I mean, I guess some people would say it's creepy, but like you can create really good experiences with that versus if you're just thumbing through Facebook and hitting like on a couple of things, you're a little bit more exposed from an advertising perspective. So I think that's a really good point.
Agreed. So we can hope, this is, at least I can hope, all the hype around NFTs and DAOs and all that, let's keep trying to, let's figure out what the actual problems those are trying to solve. Right. But the problem I want to solve with Web3 is how do we take back control over privacy? Because, you know, it's, there's going to be, if this doesn't happen, there's going to be some leak somewhere. Facebook, there'll be some sort of Facebook data is going to get dumped and it's going to be this disastrous thing for the world. Before that happens, we need to lock this stuff down.
Right. Yeah. Agreed. Let's move on. Is there anything else on Web3 that we didn't cover that you wanted to talk about? I love
for calling something stupid in the beginning, like I did. We talked about it for a while, but
yeah. But I love it. The only other thing I'll say on Web3 is we're already like, I haven't heard of a major platform being launched recently that's based off of advertising. And so there's like two forces moving against a Facebook type revenue model right now. One is subscription businesses just get valued at higher multiples. So more people want to build subscription businesses. Apple has started to invest a lot more in getting their subscription revenue up. Twitter is starting to play around with it. I don't know what's taking them so long, but we're just not seeing many advertising opportunities being created. And so I think the future with marketing is about trust. It's not just about like, there are going to be less opportunities to advertise in the future. So creating organic ways to connect.
I would say, you know, the only exception to that maybe is TikTok, right? TikTok was nowhere a couple of years ago, and that's a pretty big platform, but it's much harder to do that than it was obviously 10 years ago.
Yeah. And I think they are looking into subscription models as well. I would imagine, I mean, they have a B2B base in there, like all the creators who are building on top of these platforms. Like I think we've started to see through Patreon and Substack that there's a really viable model for creator type networks for creators who want to get paid. So it's kind of, I think they're going to have a really interesting opportunity to flip that. And it's kind of similar to YouTube, but YouTube I think is a little bit greedy with how much of the revenues they look to take for the people who build up content on their channels. I think TikTok's earlier on, so they're going to be in a better position to pivot away from an 100% advertising model and focus more on having people pay for good content.